In part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. On the program today, a story of death and survival in a place known as the Devil's Highway. The landscape is brutal. It is desert that straddles the border between the U.S. and Mexico. It's so harsh and forbidding that the Border Patrol fears it. In May of 2001, 26 Mexican men tried to cross it. 14 died. Writer Luis Alberto Urrea tells the story in his new book, The Devil's Highway. Let me share with you two short excerpts from the book. They come early in the story, in the first chapter. In many ancient religious texts, fallen angels were bound in chains and buried beneath a desert known only as desolation. This could be the place. The first white man known to die in the desert heat here did it on January 18, 1541. Most assuredly, others had died before. As long as there have been people, there have been deaths in the western desert. When the Devil's Highway was a faint scratch of desert bighorn hoof marks and the first hunters ran along it, someone died. But the brown and red men who ran the paths left no record outside of faded songs and rock paintings we still don't understand. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. In the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Luis Alberto Urrea is the author of 5 books of nonfiction, 2 works of fiction, and 3 volumes of poetry. His writing has received several awards, including the Christopher Award and the American Book Award. He has also been inducted into the Latino Literary Hall of Fame. Luis Urrea teaches creative writing at the University of Illinois at Chicago. His new book, The Devil's Highway, is published by Little Brown and Company. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Luis Urrea, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
You've been to the Devil's Highway. You describe it as terrible and beautiful. What does it feel like?
Hot. It's very hot, but it has a kind of a deadly elegance to it. You know, it's a region that obsessed Edward Abbey, for example, and several of those kind of southwestern writers go there often. There's an overlay of kind of technical dread over it because part of it goes along the southern edge of the Barry M. Goldwater bombing range. So it's a really weird location. You know, much of it you can't enter without government permission. And once you get in there, it's patrolled by Marines, fighter bombers, helicopters, all looking for things to blow up. And there are such things as abandoned squadrons of jet fighters standing around and old army tanks. And deep in the heart of some of the desert, there are these strange kind of ghost villages where they've built houses that are populated by mannequins, and they use those for target practice. So it's a really eerie place, not only the landscape, but sort of the human ghosts that inhabit it, you know?
Really surreal, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's the absolute definition of surreal. For example, there's a mountain there that I mentioned in the book called Raven's Butte, which is actually a volcanic cone. But since it's completely covered in black lava rocks, it looks like it's under a cloud. It looks shadowy and cool, but it isn't. You know, there's this amazing landscape of cactus and saguaro, lava flows, peaks, mountains. They're very colorful. There are trees there, and one would think from a distance that there was some kind of water, but they're widely scattered mesquite trees, which form a kind of an illusion in the distance of groves and forests, but you never get to the forest.
Mm-hmm. The Devil's Highway has taken many lives. You report that since the middle of the 19th century, over 400 people have died there.
Oh, yeah, that was 400 people had died, you know, in a short period. There have been thousands died there. As it started to transform, you mentioned the story of Melchior Diaz, the conquistador who was killed there in 1541. He was the first, what we would consider, I guess, white man who had been documented to have died there. And it became a transverse across the Southwest, certainly existed long before there was a Mexican border there, imposed sort of artificially, you know, with the treaty. And it was a hunting trail and a warrior's trail and a war path and then a prospector's and pioneer's path. And it remains a rough dirt road to this day all the way across southern Arizona. It goes along the edge of the border, and it parallels Mexican Route 2 and then far to the north, Route 8, Interstate 8 that goes to San Diego. They form kind of a three-road system going east to west. And I use the name of the Devil's Highway sort of as a representative name for the entire region, as well as for the entire journey, I think, of the undocumented coming into the United States.
Now, of all the people who have died in this place, what drew you to the stories of these particular men who died trying to cross the Devil's Highway?
Well, this story was interesting for a lot of reasons. One of the things that came of this particular tragedy in May of 2001 was that it really was inspiring, I think, some substantial border change, certainly in the Mexican government and in its approach to the Bush White House and so forth. I think there were border accords possibly going to be inspired by what happened, but 9/11 happened instead, and I don't mean to pun, but 9/11 blew up the border as well. You know, it exploded all the things they were going to try to have happen. And one of the weird ironies of this tragedy that I wrote about was that the survivors were suing the American government for, I believe it was $47, maybe $46 million, because essentially the government had not provided drinking fountains along the Devil's Highway. And it certainly had started a firestorm of protest, and Bill Maher on Politically Incorrect railed against it and so forth. And I think that lawsuit was a kind of political theater, really, staged by lawyers in Arizona to I don't think they ever thought they'd win $47 million, but I think they thought it would push this to the forefront of argument. And so all that was starting to happen, that was fascinating. The other thing that was fascinating about it was, you know, it was one of the biggest tragedies that had happened. Since then, we've had the amazing tragedies of the bodies found inside the tank car and the people found inside the truck trailer and so forth. But at the time, it had certainly spawned the largest manhunt in Border Patrol history, and you know, it was the biggest event since a group of 13 Salvadorans had been left to die in the 80s, which was quite a scandal back then. And so, you know, in all of its kind of awful superlatives, it was impactful, and I thought it represented the tragedy that is happening every day on the border in microcosm.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the people who died in a trailer in
right.
Texas. That was just a year ago in May.
Right.
19 undocumented workers, many right. from Mexico.
Mm-hmm. Died. Yeah, and they were, you know, they were locked in an 18-wheeler, and it was pulled off to the side of the road and left. And I think you see that the tragedy ratchets up every year, there will be some other awful atrocity. If not this year, certainly by next year, we'll have some new head-shaking thing that we hadn't imagined before. And, you know, part of the reason for that is that this border crossing is now controlled by brutal and cold-hearted crime syndicates. And, you know, the old days, I grew up in a world where the coyotes were not necessarily pleasant fellows, but they were often locals, you know, people who had little businesses smuggling people. But now these syndicates control much of the border, and it's a much more brutal, much more frightening game now.
Yeah. The smugglers, they're known as coyotes or polleros.
Polleros, yeah.
What does the word polleros mean?
A pollero is a chicken wrangler, somebody who herds chickens, which should serve, I think, as the first warning to the walkers coming here, how they're seen and how they're going to be treated.
Yeah. Who are these polleros?
My guys in my story were the walkers themselves, and the coyote are all interesting stories in that, you know, the walkers were small patch coffee farmers, essentially, from the mountains outside of the big cities of Veracruz. They were from a couple of interrelated villages in the hills, and they were men who were peasant stock, you know. Many of them were indigenous, or at least half indigenous, mestizos. Many of them spoke native languages first, then Spanish second. None of them spoke English. Many of them had never seen an escalator or an elevator. They had never taken a plane anywhere. Some of them had not ever seen a big city before. None of them had ever seen a desert. The coyote himself was a 19-year-old punk rocker from Guadalajara, and he had come north to get employment on the Mexican side of the border to send money back to his mom so she could get a home for herself. They were renting some hovel they were living in. And he had been working in a brickyard making adobe when he was recruited. Everybody in the story was recruited by the crime organization. The walkers are recruited by a man that is known in the parlance as el enganchador, which is the hooker, as in hooking a fish. And he was a Veracruz associate of these criminals, and he essentially would invite the men in hard straits out for coffee and perhaps a lunch, and he would spin the tale that they could get easy employment in the United States and he could get them the job. So they were all recruited to come to the border.
And what does it cost to get hooked?
Getting hooked is not cheap. Essentially, the come-on is this. Coffee prices had collapsed in Veracruz, so these men, what meager lives they were making, had suddenly evaporated. So Don Moy was this man's name, Moises. Moses shows up and says, look, boys, I can get you a job for the summer. We have an associate in Florida, and they need orange pickers. You're already farmers. You're used to that kind of work. It's a nice, warm state like Veracruz. Easy to get there. You know, we can put you through the pipeline. So let's see. To go up there and get a ride across the border in vehicles will cost you $2,500. And the guy's balk at the price, and he says, well, if you're really macho, if you're really men, and you can stand a little walking, I can get you walking across $1,700 to $1,800 a head. So they say, well, we'll walk, but we don't have the money. So part of the genius of the scam is, oh, well, let me see if I can get my associates to get a deal for you. And he works his cell phone. Most of them have never seen a cell phone, so it's kind of Star Trek to them, you know. Gets off the cell phone and says, just for you, just this week, I can get you financing. My associates want to help you, so here's the deal. I will give each of you, I will give you credit for the trip, but we will have to charge 15% interest, and it's compounded monthly. So you guys, we'll give you the credit, but you have to sign over all your possessions and what little land you have, and, you know, you pay us off. So essentially what they're really doing is working a slave trade, in that these men then belong to the company store because you'll never pay off a debt like that. And at the last moment, they're also told, basically, by the way, you understand we don't want to do it, but we'll have to hurt your wives if you skip out on your debt.
Mm.
So these men have essentially been kidnapped. They don't know it yet.
Do stories come back to the places that these men come from? Stories of those who went before them? That would be cautionary?
They're starting to. One of the curious paradigms that rules the border now is that many of the stories that are fueling the immigration are the story of Uncle Juan or Uncle Pepe who went. And in the couple of years since Uncle went, it has changed radically. So, you know, the story is, well, he went and it wasn't that bad. They don't know that now it's much worse than it used to be. That's part of it. Also, since the border law enforcement has ratcheted up the difficulties, and since the coyotes have ratcheted up the difficulties, the general cost of crossing the border has risen. So, you know, the base cost is estimated at around $700 or $800 now from the border itself. That is just so much hassle and so much cost that a lot of these guys who've crossed over don't go back. They're staying longer. And the longer they stay, the more the border changes. So consequently, there's an information gap. Now, my event I wrote about is one of the very first huge shocks back to the Mexican system that started to spread out, you know, through the folklore. And it's a cautionary tale, too. And one of the reasons for my book, even though Mexico is not necessarily an overwhelmingly literate country, was that I'm hoping ultimately it'll serve as a kind of a warning down to Mexico, too, about what the situation is. And frankly, it's changing so fast that it has evolved since I worked on the book already. There are new things happening. It'll change every year.
Yeah. What is happening that's new?
Now they're having these really strange, it's almost like the narco wars. In fact, if you think about Scarface and Traffic and all the narco kind of stories, that sort of paradigm is taking over the human smuggling. And these groups are starting to battle each other for possession of the human beings. And there are some amazing tales of one group having done surveillance on the other group's smuggling. And when the smugglers picked up the load of bodies and are heading to Phoenix, the other group then attacks them, guns blazing, shoots all the drivers and guards and hijacks the bodies and takes them for themselves, which is really weird. I mean, it's like piracy on the high desert, you know?
Mm-hmm.
There's also this new thing happening where when I was doing my book, my research was in 2002, early 2003. Since then, they have changed their safe house system. They used to use trailers, garages, barrio houses, where they would hide the people in Mexican and indigenous communities. Now what they're doing is finding nice suburban, essentially white neighborhoods, sort of like where I live in the suburbs of Chicago and Naperville, and they're renting a big middle-class homes and bringing the people in at night and stuffing these houses with 200 people. They're standing in these empty houses shoulder to shoulder waiting, and they transport them. You know, they pull a van into the garage, close the garage door, put the people in the van, and the van drives out. So it's completely invisible, but much more high stakes. So, and this is essentially echoing what happens with drug smugglers as they do more and more elaborate things to fool the government.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of a weird, you know, it's like this hidden America that we don't know is going on.
Yeah. Well, the letter from the publisher, Little Brown, that came with the copy of your book begins, "Dear reviewer, this March ushers in another killing season in the Southwest for scores of Mexican nationals attempting to illegally cross into the United States through southern Arizona's deadliest stretch of desert." what are the governments doing here? You mentioned 9/11 as came along, and that kind of just threw the border situation in an entirely different direction.
Yeah.
What is Mexico doing? What is the United States doing? if we're, you know, I mean, if and it sounds, you know, what you just told me about these narco wars, narco-like wars, it sounds like the situation is even worse than what you spell out in The Devil's Highway.
Yeah, I hate to say that, but I do think it's worse in a lot of ways. You know, I think the Mexican side of this equation is a very deeply schizophrenic situation. And, you know, we have on the one hand the supposed collapse of the dictatorship. I mean, nobody comes out and says PRI was a dictatorship, but it was certainly oligarchical, if nothing else. And so they had a 70-year reign. And the Fox Revolution, whatever it ultimately turns out to have been, was an attempt to stop it and bring in democracy. So some wags in Mexico called it perestroika for Mexico. We were going to have border perestroika, which was a very interesting thing happening. But democracy doesn't happen overnight. And you have 70 years of absolute power by men who have absolute profits off the backs of the peasants. You're not going to change it overnight. That was going on. I also like to point out that President Fox is the first Coca-Cola executive to run Mexico. So he had, I think, a business plan in mind. If you remember when he came to the United States and had his first pre-9/11 publicity tours with President Bush, he was talking profits. He abandoned all the rhetoric of human rights and sovereignty and all this stuff that had always been said before, and talked about profits. And he pointed out that the United States could have $30 billion profit in partnership with Mexico. That really got the ears of people in Washington. That was all afoot. The other side of this issue, however, is that Mexico is benefiting mightily from illegal immigration. Hugely. One of the things that illegal immigration does for Mexico is, I believe, it diffuses revolution. The populace is desperate in Mexico and angry and frantic to have change just to feed their families. So it's easier than fighting the Mexican system to brave the border and try to come here. The other thing that I think is deeply cynical about what's happening in Mexico is that they're getting billions of dollars back in remittance money. So many people work here that they send back literally billions of dollars into the Mexican economy. I suspect that money is still going to the same people who have run everything. If it were going into the general population, it might transform Mexico, and maybe it still will. You know, I joke sometimes that we have a very generous foreign policy toward Mexico that we filter through Burger King, you know, to get back there. Certainly Western Union is making a whole lot of money. So that's going on. And I was recently down in Sonora in one of the main smuggling villages talking to immigration police from the Mexican side. And they were pretty frank. They're astonishingly philosophical for men who live in, you know, the middle of a desert in a little hut. And they said, you know, this is keeping our country afloat. It's not even a problem anymore. It's a phenomenon, and you can't solve a phenomenon. It's beyond us. And, one of the cops said, you've got to understand that this is the second largest source of income for the nation, and so it's not going to stop.
But it sounds like it could be drying up.
Well,
from what you said about in terms of the people who are crossing end up owning their souls, owing their earnings, their future earnings,
right,
to the polleros.
You know, I suspect that the phenomenon of profits for Mexico is from the people already established here. I think that the greed and depravity involved in this human hunting and so forth that goes on is going to cause a lot of trouble for that system. And also, you know, I mean, the system, as long as we have low-paying jobs that American citizens don't want, that system will continue to work. If jobs stop, the flow will stop. It's. I know people feel that it's about welfare and benefits and so forth, but it's really at base about work and money. So if there's some kind of economic revival in Mexico of some sort, and if there were a closure of those jobs here, then the tide would probably not only stop but reverse itself. I don't know what could make that happen, however.
Mm. Well, the season of death, the killing season, it coincides with the time of year when crops here are ripening, are
right.
reaching maturity.
Exactly.
So it begins in March, and it stretches.
It's already begun. In fact, you know, it's one of the weird ironies of all this that, of course, our picking seasons begin just as the temperature spikes along the border. So I guess about a week and a half ago, the first three bodies were found, and the Arizona headlines were, "And so it begins."
Mm.
And ironically enough, they found four more people who had died of the cold because they'd gone up to the high country and a cold snap came through. So, you know, as I point out in one part of the book, it's not always what you would assume in that people do die from the heat, but they die from the cold, and they die from snake bite, and they die from murder and suicide, and they die from heart attacks and strokes. You know, one of the paradigms that came up that I injected at the last second into the book before it went to press because I thought it was so amazing is that smugglers have started giving their walkers at gunpoint, essentially, uppers to make them go faster. And they were going to use cocaine, but cocaine was too expensive to squander on illegals. So some of these guys give them overdoses of over-the-counter diet pills. They give them ephedra, and they get extremely jittery, and they move extremely fast. They can get them to double time. But the problem with that is that it leads to heart attacks and all kinds of horrible, you know. But the polleros don't care one way or the other. At first, they were paid cash up front, so they were already paid. What do they care? And if these people are in hock, they don't care anyway because then they still get profit, whether they die or not, because somebody somewhere owes the money. And so they can put the collectors on them to keep on them for money. And they don't care if that means you have to send two or three more people until someone gets a job. Somebody owes it, so sooner or later. You know, they're starting to think now in big picture terms, which really worries me. It used to be a, you know, short-term event. I'm going to make this money this weekend. Now they're thinking years down the line. It's now corporate crime. Somewhere, one of the people in the Border Patrol told me, "You've uncovered something bigger than what you think you have." And there are people somewhere, you know, in some kind of corporate office with big plans, you know, and they're layering in a gigantic, you know, drug-style illegal corporation, basically.
Luis Alberto Urrea is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is The Devil's Highway. It's a story of death and survival in a place known as the Devil's Highway, the desert that straddles the border between the U.S. and Mexico. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The Border Patrol is collectively a character in the story, and it's a pretty complex character, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is. You know, last night, you might find this interesting, I did a reading here in town, and one of the Border Patrol guys that has been emailing me and giving me a little bit of advice and feedback and so forth came, and it was very interesting. I'd never met him face-to-face, and he removed one of his service medallions and gave it to me. He said, "I want you to have this. because you changed my life with your stuff. And I was so shocked, but, you know, I've been shocked all the way down the line dealing with these agents, because I went into it with a kind of attitude, well, being Mexican-American, for one, you know, being pretty liberal, having come out of the whole Chicano literature movement and all that sort of thing. I had very strong feelings about the Border Patrol, and they weren't positive. I just saw them as my enemies and all this sort of thing. And the initial defense of the coyote that I wrote the book about, or partially wrote the book about, was that the Border Patrol was responsible for the tragedy in several weird ways. Anyway, it was very difficult to penetrate their world. And it didn't occur to me that the very prejudices I was carrying was why it's hard to get into the Border Patrol. They know people have these feelings about them, on the right and the left. They are berated by every group. You know, the liberals and the conservatives make fun of them and insult them and so forth. And they do have characters in the Border Patrol that do awful things, as any military or law enforcement agency does. There's somebody somewhere who snaps. That's all true. But when I was finally allowed access to them after 4 months of fruitless courting, and I started going out with them and hanging out with them and getting agents away from anybody else where there was no reason to start towing the company line and hearing what was in their hearts as human beings, it was transformative for me, because I realized that, in fact, the Border Patrol is what accidentally gave me this book, in that I realized suddenly one day that this agent I was with out in the desert was somebody I cared for deeply as a person. And it was such a shock to me, thinking, no, wait a minute, I cannot love a Border Patrol agent. That's not in the rules. And I did. And I would go home at night to my hotel and think about these guys, and realized that without them, it wouldn't be 14 dead men in my book. It would be 26 dead men. No matter, at the very base of everything I was doing, the fact was that if the Border Patrol had not been there, these guys would all have died. They rescued them. And this agent said to me, when I brought this up to him, he said, look, my job is this. The very fact that they are here in my country means that they've already broken federal law. So my job is to catch a criminal. Everyone here, he said, is already a criminal. It's a given. The other side of the issue is, my job is equally to rescue innocent people who are dying of exposure. He said, those jobs are often about the same person. Mm-hmm. Now, if I think about that, he said, I go crazy. So I have to come here and put myself away and become the migra agent and just do my job, whichever direction it goes, and not think about these dichotomies, or I'll go crazy. And he told me this interesting little tidbit, which I put in the book, which was, you know, if you look into these Border Patrol guys, a whole lot of them live quite a long distance from where they're stationed. And he said the unspoken reason for this is they need time. They need time in the morning to get up for the game, but even more so, they need time at the end of the day before they can go home to hold their children and love their wives. They need time to get out of the game. And that little gap of the time it takes to get ready for war or to get out of the battle really started to affect me and my understanding of what I was trying to write.
Mm. And that agent who gave you a medal, who said, your book transformed me, was transformative. How was he transformed?
It's a really amazing story, actually. He was a Border Patrol agent in San Diego. And he had my first book, which was about missionary work in Tijuana, in his truck. And I've been stunned over the years to find out that Border Patrol guys read my stuff. I've heard this a couple of times, which shocks me, especially because those early books are pretty hard on the Border Patrol. But he said he was on patrol, and he was taking his break, sitting in the truck on the line, looking at Tijuana, and he started reading my book, and he broke out crying. And you know, it stuck with him so much. It's, you know, he's had it on his mind ever since. And that what do you say to that? You know, as a writer, of course, that's the greatest compliment. That's better than a paycheck. And, you know, and so he sent me an email and told me that, and I told him I was doing this book. So, you know, he would listen to my various things, and he would pray for me. And I used to think, wow, you know, a Border Patrol guy praying for you, that's a pretty ironic detail right there, you know. But I think his presence was good for me to remind me that these guys are human beings. It's always about human beings. And the walkers, it was important for me that Americans know that these aren't faceless masses, brown invaders, but men and women with children and moms and wives and husbands, and they're trying to eat and they don't know what to do. You know, and even the smugglers, they're human beings too, who have a reason for being there. But when I realized that the Border Patrol were human beings, that was the book.
Yeah.
That this is a phenomenon of individuals, human individuals in a foreboding and forbidding place, trying to make the best out of utter confusion.
Well, the walkers have that sense of the Border Patrol as well, I think. There's a scene in the book where the men are faced with a choice, cross the road and stagger along the front range of the mountains or stay on the road and hope the Border Patrol finds them.
Right.
They're nemesis, you're right.
Yeah. But, you know, when you're dying, suddenly things are in a whole different perspective, right? And I think the choice is easy. Cop or death? Cop or death? I'll take the cop, thanks. You know, and anybody would. But there are these... It's remarkable when you get into the world, if you can get their trust to learn what kind of relationships they have. I will betray a confidence to tell you that the wives of one of the Border Patrol agents, one of the wives, sent me an email, and she said, you know, you'll never know this, but so-and-so, her husband, many times would leave the station on Friday after payday and instead of coming home, go to the bank and cash his paycheck and then buy groceries and take it back to the holding pens and feed everybody. And she said that with admiration but a little frustration too because, you know, they're waiting for the paycheck at home, but he would be compelled to go back and feed them. You know, and one of the guys said to me, you cannot carry a dead 12-year-old girl in your arms for miles out of a desert and not have human feelings. You can't. You know? And they're very aware of their reputation. One of my friends now from the Border Patrol, who was an informant for the book, always refers to himself as a jackbooted thug because he knows what people think of him. And, in fact, he came up with this wonderful phrase, which I wished I'd had for the book, where he said, we are jackbooted thugs in shining armor, which I thought was just a marvelous,
yeah.
quote.
Yeah, terrific metaphor. Let's talk with a caller, a listener in Charleston.
Okay.
On line four. Good afternoon.
Yes, I'm really taken aback by your guest and this subject matter. And it just seems unbelievable. I'm not a naive kid. I understand how the world works. And knowing that, and the use of money, and the horrors of exploitation and colonialism, are we ever going to get to where we need to go in order that humanity can control its society? I mean, the things you've been describing makes me think, you know, the humanitarian act of this fellow taking groceries back to where these people are kept is more or less an aside.
Yes.
The general picture, you know, it seems to be one just clamoring for resolution.
Yes, sir.
And it just is, I am just overwhelmed by that. You know, I'm an old man and I've read all my life. And I understand those things have happened throughout time, but here we are in the 21st century, and we have this madness in Iraq, the things that you are discussing on this program today, and it's just traumatic. You know, the human life is so cheap and so worthless that they are used to enrich someone. You know, it reminds me of the use of children in England and the U.S. In the 19th century.
Yes.
And beyond. And just to exploit these innocents, I think, you know, what more is has to happen before people in general will understand what's been going on for too long? Well, I hope I haven't ran on, but it's very interesting, and you're a very articulate gentleman.
Thanks, sir.
I appreciate your book and your comments. I mean, I just had to let you know how I felt. And thank you very much, sir.
Thank you so much, sir. He's right. I mean, it is shocking. I feel that there is some kind of new approach to the border, and it seems to be circulating just outside my field of vision. I feel like I cannot see the solution, because I do think, I mean, I don't want to be too cosmic, but it's almost a theological question, not a political question. Mm. There's something so much about damnation and wickedness and evil involved in this story that just is overwhelming to me. And I will tell you something, that the fear of sounding alarmist, because I certainly don't want to join the all immigrants are evil invasion kind of thing that's going on. But about 3 weeks ago, we went down to the smuggling village in the heart of all this region in Sonora, and we took one of my Border Patrol retired, lest the government get after him, because he can't be there. He's a retired Border Patrol guy in Mexico, and a film director and some reporters. And we went into this town called Sasabe, which used to be a little desert cattle ranching town. It's about 2 miles south of Tucson by back road. It's now, there is not a single cow in sight. The entire town of Sasabe is dedicated to smuggling. And south of Sasabe, there's a staging area called Ladrillera, which means the brickyard. And if you can envision a scene literally lifted out of the Road Warrior, that's what it looked like. It was vast desert, completely surrounded by destroyed cars torn in half, burned, exploded, piles and piles and piles of adobe brick, abandoned since they no longer make brick, so it's all melting back into the soil. Little shacks and hovels and garbage everywhere. This is where the vans in Mexico pull in and transfer their walkers to four-wheel drive trucks, which then take them up to Sasabe to the border, where they begin their walk. I was there with Mexican immigration police, who are so afraid in this place that they lock themselves inside the police station at nightfall and don't come back out until morning, so they don't know what happens after dark. The week before I was there, two people had been executed outside the police station by drug smugglers. And when we pulled up, the chief of police came out and said, "Well, you're lucky, because I have a dead corpse here. We already found a dead guy, and he's in this trailer." We wanted to go to Ladrillera, and he said, "You don't go by yourself. It's very dangerous. Take our police with you." So they took us in a convoy to this place. The Border Patrol guy was, thank goodness he was there on one side, because he recognized people who were surveilling us. And in fact, the narco people were coming out of their ranch and started sort of setting up a perimeter to keep an eye on us, because they weren't used to seeing gringos in this town. All these white faces. Anyway, the point being that the vans began arriving, and the officer that was with me, I was born in Tijuana, and so was this cop, so we had this nice rapport. He told me the day before, a Friday, they had interdicted 144 van loads of people, 30 people each van coming north. The people came to this town. They were all Oaxacan, interestingly enough, all Indians. Some of them didn't speak Spanish. They were all being led north. They were told it was a 3-hour walk to Phoenix. Now, if you know the area, it's a 2-hour drive to Tucson. Tucson is a further 2 to 3 hour drive to Phoenix. These people thought they were going to walk there in 3 hours. So that gives you a sense. Every one of those people had been hit up for money. I would venture that many of those people had been nailed by one of these hookers and was completely in hock. This meant that if they died, their loved ones would then be visited by violent and frightening men to extort whatever, you know. And of course, the figure is arbitrary. The $1,700 is arbitrary. They just made it up. People are charged whatever they charge because it doesn't matter what they charge. If they get you for the loan, you're stuck no matter what they've charged you. So you hear some people pay $2,000, some people pay $700. The idea is to get you in debt.
You know, you've talked about the spiritual aspects of this problem, but it is also a political problem. And part of that political problem is immigration policy.
Yeah.
Before we have to wrap up, we have a little extra time today in this portion of the program. Before we wrap up, I want to do a couple of things. I want to ask you about that. And then I want to ask you to talk with us about the walkers in this story, The Devil's Highway. We've referred to them as in terms of their number, 26.
Yes.
And they were also called the Yuma 14.
Right.
And before we go, I want to put some faces on these walkers.
Okay.
But before we do that, I want to talk about this political question. What would a sane, workable immigration agreement between the U.S. and Mexico look like?
Oh, gosh. You know, one of the Mexican politicians told me that this crisis is the product of the politics of stupidity on both sides, which I thought was an eerie quote and a wonderful quote. I'm not quite sure what it meant, but I knew in my gut that he was right. The policies we have are stupid. On a human level, I think they're stupid. I think that this is about profits, and what we have to really look at is, you know, an honest accounting to the American people of what big business is profiting from this. If they weren't, the border would not be what it is today. If the captains of industry were not being able to union bust and suppress minimum wage and get cheap labor, this wouldn't be happening. That being said, we also know that our food is largely processed and collected by people working at slave wages, and that keeps your produce from costing a lot more money. So you and I also, we like a 49-cent can of peas. We don't want a $9 can of peas. And that's something I think somebody honestly should give us these options and say this is the true situation. I think it's easy to use it for propaganda purposes and all these other things. You know, when you're with the Border Patrol and they tell you things like, A, if we had our way, we would leave this border right now and begin patrolling corporate headquarters. Now, that's hardly from a, you know, bleeding heart liberal Marxist theoretician. This is from a right-wing ex-Marine Border Patrol man. When they tell you, B, we have a region here on the border we know is filtering the most illegal walkers through, and we have interdicted a couple of thousand people in one weekend and are getting ready to go do it. When our station chief comes out and says, where are you going? We say, we're going back to the pass. And he says, no, you're not. We've been asked to let a few more walk through. You have to ask yourself, well, why? They know perfectly well why. They've been told that there's a shortage of workers somewhere. So they have to let some through so that the crop can be collected. And C, I would say that, you know, take any number of other quotes. I could give you an index of quotes of things that they've experienced that they see happening there. So, you know, I think people really need to understand that this is a question of profits. It's truly a financial arrangement. And it's not just the coyotes. It's not just the smugglers who are using human suffering. It's not. I've been involved in investigations in Louisiana, you know, with my wife. She's an investigative reporter. I mean, you know, you can watch the news wires. Anybody who's interested in this, I would suggest they keep an eye on the Arizona Republic news wire on the Internet or the or the Tucson Citizen. They have websites one can check. If you go to my website, we're starting to put up an index of websites because, you know, I've been astounded at the level of interest, but I've also been astounded at the level of compassion. We're led to believe that everybody is furious and rageful and hates these walkers, and people don't. I think what people hate is the level of horrible suffering these folks are going through. So we're putting up websites where you can check for yourself and start watching the numbers and start watching the policies. If I were advising President Fox, I would tell him that a really smart move right now to ease tensions with the United States would probably be to try to fill some of the OPEC gap with oil. You know, I think that would be a really interesting move. I wish there were something Mexico could do to stanch this flow just for a while for everyone to collect their breaths. I don't think it will happen. Mm. One of the Mexican politicians told me one of the crises we have in Mexico is that 80 cents of every dollar is owed to foreign debt. Is it worth it to us to relieve that foreign debt? It might be in the long run. I don't know. Mm. You know, the guy said to me, if we can't afford to have exports, then the only thing we can export is the makers who can't make them things we couldn't export, then we send them to you. That's a really tough scene. So I don't know. I wish I were a politician. One of the things that I started really sensing as I worked on this book is that if I could try to put a human face on it, and if I could use this story, because let's face it, at base, this is a story like The Perfect Storm or Into Thin Air, and that it's a tragic adventure. But I thought that this tragic adventure could insert education to people who don't know what's happening so that they can see as much of what I can report as I can get in there. You know what I mean? And move it in perhaps like a Trojan horse into the heart of America and say, this is really what I'm trying to get to you, is this report from the ground zero.
Yeah.
That you don't know about.
We only have a couple of minutes left now. And before we go, please put a face on one of the 14.
Okay. I will tell you about Raimundo Barreda. He was worked as a bottle washer and box carrier at Pepsi-Cola plant and was laid off. And, you know, he had a fairly substantial family, very much loved his wife, and had decided that they needed one room added to their little house, one room, and he wanted to build it out of cement blocks so it would be a quality room for his wife, a new bedroom. So he decided to go. His son, Raimundo Jr., named after him, was a soccer star, 15 years old, going to turn 16, wanted to go, wanted to help his father, wanted to help his mother. His father didn't want him to go, and Raimundo Jr. said, if you don't take me, I'll find a way to go by myself. So his dad decided,